to start by apologising for the format of this talk. Not being a child of the information revolution, I always have a certain amount of difficulty in preparing talks, even though I get a lot of help. And the fact that I'm away from home hasn't made it abusive, though again, I've had quite a lot of help with. So I'm going to be giving basically the first two thirds of the talk, roughly, from slides, and then switching to handwritten view graphs, the last third. And that sort of makes some sense, because as you'll see, the last third is of a rather different nature than the first two thirds. Okay, so I'd like to start this talk with an experiment. How many of you have not, at some time in your career, been through a sort of standard textbook of solid state physics, like, say, Kittel or Ashcroft and Murn? Almost nobody. Okay, so all you've been through, one of these standard solid state textbooks, which deal, broadly speaking, with the properties of crystalline matter, and they show you these incredibly nice results about band theory, and so on and so forth. Now, I would like you to point, each of you to point, to some object in your environment here, which is well described by that theory. Any takers? I doubt it, frankly. I suspect this does it some multiple plastic. Not at all well described by the theory of crystalline solids. If you look hard, you can probably find a few. But what the point I'm making, obviously, is that in everyday life, as distinct from, say, the interiors of neutron stars and things like that, in everyday terrestrial life, crystalline solids are really very much an exception. Almost all the matter around us, including the most important kind of matter, like say this, is most certainly not a crystalline solid. What is it? Well, let's just start with the. Let's see if I make this work. Yes. Here's a standard textbook phase diagram of some substance, some ordinary substance such as say water. And so, at high temperatures and low pressures, we have the vapor phase, which we're not going to be particularly interested in. So let me just use this to invite you to interrupt at any time. I don't want this to be very formal.
We need this.
Yes, okay.
For recording.
Yeah, so as I say, means feel free to interrupt at any time. Okay, so here we have the liquid phase, solid phase down here. And crudely speaking, the main characteristics of the liquid phase is that once we time average the particle density, it's pretty much spatially uniform. And secondly, a liquid cannot sustain shear. If we assume for the moment that our solid is a crystalline solid, as described by the standard textbooks, then, first of all, if we define the Fourier components of the time average density, then in general we'll find some wave vectors which are not zero, such that these Fourier components are finite. In other words, we get a periodic, a permanent periodic variation of the density. Secondly, the second important property of solids, which distinguishes them from liquids, is that the shear modulus is non-zero. Now, the general belief is, although I don't think it's really ever been rigorously proved, but the general belief is that in the thermodynamic limit, the ground state of any element or any mixture of elements in constant proportions is either a crystalline solid or very exceptionally and occasionally a liquid. In fact, the only case at terrestrial pressures and densities, at least, where we know that the ground state is a liquid is actually the two isotopes of helium. There are some what appear to be partial exceptions to this rule in the sense of quasi-crystals, and I'm not going to discuss those, but generally speaking, we would expect that we get either a crystalline solid or a liquid. And the second general belief, again, I think not ever rigorously proved, either theoretically or experimentally, is that at sufficiently slow cooling at a constant pressure, you'll actually obtain this ground state. Yes?
What about Bormann?
What about what, sorry? What about, yes, what about boron?
Not piston.
No, I'm sorry?
It's not piston.
Never?
While I think that under best expansion conditions, it's not piston.
Really? Okay, that was something I didn't know. I mean, it's okay, so then it'll fall in under the main topic of my talk. Okay, good. Thank you for that. In any case, the question obviously arises, first of all, what is sufficiently slow? And secondly, what happens if the cooling is not sufficiently slow, as in real life it may well not be? Well, intuitively, what I think you would tend to expect is that if you have sorry, this should be rare gas, actually, is the typo there. If you had a single rare gas element, say, xenon or whatever, then I think you'd expect that it'd be relatively easy to cool it, to anneal it, to form a crystalline lattice. If you have mixtures of rare gases, that's a little not quite so clear. And I've actually tried to find, when I was preparing this talk, I tried to find literature, experimental literature, where people had actually tried to deliberately to mix four or five different rare gases, so different sizes, and to cool them and see how easily or not it formed a crystal. And I couldn't really find anything, surprisingly. In any case, for these reasonably simple systems, you might intuitively expect that it would form a crystal easily. For more complicated molecules, like, say, large biomolecules, your intuition would be, I think, it's much more difficult for the molecules to find the correct crystalline arrangement. And so they might well end up in some kind of rather frustrated state. And indeed, that is what does seem to happen. If we take an ordinary liquid, a stable thermodynamic phase at, say, room temperature, and we cool it at constant pressure, we may find, this is done under sufficiently careful conditions, that even below the temperature where the crystalline phase is known to be thermodynamically stable, we still get a liquid phase, a so-called supercooled liquid. You can do this even with sufficient care. You can actually do it with water, but probably easier things to do it with. If you go a little further down, then you come to what is usually called the glass transition or vitrification. And as far as we know, at least, the glass transition is not a phase transition, but it's rather a dramatic change of the kinetic coefficients. Most spectacularly, you typically get a huge change in viscosity by anything up to 17 orders of magnitude as you go through the glass transition. So I've drawn a line here, which I've labeled as T sub G for glass, but that's somewhat a matter of convention and will depend to some extent on the cooling rate. The usual convention for where the glass transition occurs is the point at which the viscosity is something like 10 to the 12 Pascal seconds. You may not be used to this unit. It's the standard SI unit of viscosity. And just for reference, if you consider water at room temperature, that's about 10 to the minus 3 Pascal seconds. So about 10 to the 15 times that is roughly where you get a glass. You always find that the glass transition is below the transition to a crystalline solid, typically about 0.7 of it. What are the defining characteristics of the glass phase, or perhaps more correctly, the amorphous solid phase? Well, first of all, you have no crystalline order. That means that any non-zero Fourier component of the time average density is of order 1 over some power of the volume. So that simply basically just says you have no crystalline order. Nevertheless, if you take the time average of the correlations of a row of time 0 and time t, you generally find it's not 0. In other words, or not equal to rho 0, it's simply trivially to the average density squared. In other words, there does appear to be a non-trivial variation of the density, which is more or less constant in time. This sort of corresponds to, I think, to our intuitive notion of a glass. Finally, you have a non-zero shear modulus, apparently over experimental timescales. Now, one of the amusing problems, which is often discussed in the literature, is whether glasses are in fact nothing more than extremely viscous liquids. And for a long time, there was a sort of standard argument, which the popular reviews used to give you, to the effect that the slumping of the thickening of cathedral glass windows at the bottom was evidence that the glass which made the windows had a finite ability to flow. In other words, its viscosity was not infinite. That does seem to be a myth. There's a nice paper in American Journal of Physics a few years ago which goes through the numbers and points out that really this can't possibly be the explanation. There has to be some other explanation of why the cathedral windows are thick at the bottom. Yep.
The liquid phase to the super cool liquid, only then you have the transition to the glass.
Yeah.
But the super cool liquid is unstable to perturbation, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So does that mean that the glass phase is also unstable to perturbation?
No. Well, it depends what kind of perturbation you're talking about.
Like,
but say
shaking.
No, I mean the glass. Once you've got your glass phase, you can shake it quite a lot, generally speaking, and it'll stay more or less the same. So. Now, you could, as I say, it would be possible to regard this as simply evidence for extremely high viscosity. It's just like molasses, basically, only more so. So it's a question which is debated in the theoretical community as to whether, in some sense, at low enough temperatures, the effective viscosity of your glass really is infinite or not. Okay, you have glasses come in all shapes and sizes. You have silicate glasses, borosilicate, lead crystal, high polymer, electrolyte solutions, many other kinds. And well, as we just heard, apparently boron. I didn't know that, but that's apparently an elemental glass. They may often do contain electric or magnetic dipole moments. They may show ferromagnetism, spin glassy behavior, normal metallic behavior, for example, this compound here, even superconductivity. Surprisingly, before the advent of the high temperature superconductors, some of the highest temperature superconductors were actually amorphous, or at least partially so. Now, generally speaking, if you'd consider non-magnetic and non-metallic glasses, and that's what I'll be doing in this talk, there are really, I think one can isolate three major classes of problem. The first class of problems, which has attracted an enormous amount of attention in the literature, has to do with the glass transition itself. What exactly governs the behavior of the viscosity, say, in the neighborhood of the glass transition? There are fairly well developed experimental formulae for this, and it's an interesting question to see how far one can try to derive these theoretically. There's a whole lot of questions associated with the glass transition. Second set of questions has to do with what happens once you've firmly established the glass phase, but nevertheless are prepared to wait a long time, as it were. So you've got all sorts of interesting aging and relaxation effects, which seem to be characteristic of glasses. Again, these have attracted a lot of attention in the literature. Both of these questions, in some sense, require you to explore not just the bit of the phase space close to the sort of starting configuration of the glass, but rather a whole much wider range in the phase space. The third class of questions, which is what I'm going to be talking about exclusively in this talk, has to do with exploring the region close to the metastable minimum which the glass actually forms. So we're not going to be concerned here with these aging or long-time relaxation type effects. But rather, we're going to be worried about the thermal properties, the ultrasonic absorption properties, the thermal conductivity, and in principle at least, some of the dielectric properties, although I won't talk explicitly about those in this talk. Okay, What's the minimal model one might try to construct of the thermal and ultrasonic properties of glasses? I think there's one obvious model which swims immediately into your mind. You say to yourself, well, look, the only real difference between a crystalline solid and a glass is that in the glass, the atoms or molecules, these would really be more complicated objects, molecules, they've settled into, they haven't had time to find the crystalline arrangement, so they've settled into some kind of metastable state, which is it has sort of random positions and bond orientations of your molecules. If you take that model seriously and consider small deviations from it, then in both cases, you can write down a Hamiltonian, which is standard form, simple kinetic energy, potential energy here. And if you then expand the potential around the metastable minimum, you get this bilinear form here. And so an interesting point about this is that no matter how complicated the form of this quantity Vij alpha beta here, incidentally, here, I think I'll be sticking with this. No, I'm afraid I may not, in fact, in the rest of the talk. But anyway, one of the pairs of suffixes is it indicates Cartesian indices, and the other indicates the actual atoms I'm talking about, the pair of atoms I'm talking about here. Okay, but that's just a standard bilinear Hamiltonian. So you know that you can, however complicated this expression may be, you can diagonalize it, and you can express the total energy of your system in terms of a set of harmonic oscillators. Now, you don't know a lot ahead of time about what the nature of these oscillators is. I mean, you don't know, for example, whether the modes in question are going to be localized or delocalized. However, there are certain things we can say on this basis. The first and most, in some sense, the most important thing we can say on the basis of this very minimal model is that you would not, in this model, expect any nonlinear effects. As you know, whether we're talking classical mechanics or quantum mechanics, the harmonic oscillator is, in some sense, the most linear system known to man. And if you are just perturbing it with a linear force, which we'll assume you are, then its response is indeed precisely linear. And you would not expect effects like saturation or echoes or anything like that to occur with a set of them. And that's independent of what the detailed structure of these oscillators actually is. The second inference one could draw from this is that rather generally you get an expression for the specific heat, which is simply the sum or integral of the contribution from these different oscillators. So we can express it in this form here, where rho of omega is the density of states per unit frequency range of my oscillators. Now, a slightly more specific conclusion one can draw is that in the limit of zero frequency, there's a rather strong argument, again, I think probably not 100% rigorous, but very convincing, that the only contribution you're likely to get in this limit, barring pathology, is from long wavelength, longitudinal and transverse modes. And when you've got to these long wavelengths, you're averaging over a vast number of individual atoms or molecules. And so you can basically treat your system as an elastic continuum. So in the long wavelength limit, then, you would expect to be able to treat glasses as elastic continua, which have only two modes of oscillation, longitudinal and transverse, that is compressional and shear, vibration with appropriate frequencies. But apart from these, however, when you go to shorter, to higher frequencies, you would expect that you could get, and usually do get, local higher frequency localized modes. A final amusing consequence that you can draw is that if you assume this simple model, this minimal model, and assume that under both compressional and shear stress, the array of atoms simply expands uniformly, which is not totally obvious, but it seems a very reasonable assumption, then you can make the following prediction, that the ratio of the speeds of transverse to longitudinal sound is 1/√3. Does anyone know any reference where this result is published? we tried to find it. My co-author got very excited about this and insisted on putting in a little appendix on this. I strongly suspect it was actually proved by Lord Rayleigh sometime in the late 19th century, but anyway, it does seem to be true. And it's one of those things I think which is sort of folk knowledge. Now, which of these predictions is actually right? Well, four, let me just go back for a moment. Four was that you expect high-frequency localized modes, and that seems to be at least qualitatively consistent with experiment, in that you do always in glasses seem to get a so-called boson peak in the specific heat, which you see. You see it in the specific heat. You also see it, evidence for it in inelastic neutron scattering. So that does seem to be qualitatively at least right. And that seemed to be a rather general characteristic of most glasses. The second second point is that number five, which remember was this ratio, CL over CT, that's usually verified within about 10%, and often quite a lot better than that. So that's so far satisfactory. However, if you combine statements two and three, remember two is just the standard formula for the specific heat of a set of harmonic oscillators, and three, was that the long wavelength, the low frequency excitations are simply long wavelength phonons. Combine those two results, and you find that in the limit that the temperature goes to zero, basically the thermodynamics, the specific heat of a glass, should be exactly the same as that of a crystal. The only difference is that whereas in a crystal, the longitudinal and transverse modes may have a velocity which is somewhat dependent on direction relative to the crystal axes. In the glass, you don't have any crystal axes, and therefore they have to be isotropic. But apart from that, you'd expect they're exactly the same. You'd expect, in other words, that you get the standard Debye specific heat law. And until about 1970, that was regarded as so obvious that I think people didn't, by and large, bother to test it. They just assumed it was going to be true. However, when Bobby Pohl at Cornell got around in 1970 to testing it, he found a big surprise. Turns out that for almost all amorphous solids below about 1 degree K, you find a specific heat which is much larger than T cubed, goes to zero much slower than T cubed. It's usually represented as T to the 1 plus alpha, where alpha tends to lie in the range of 0.2 to 0.3. But the sort of the rather sloppy statement you often get in the literature is that the specific heat is linear in temperature, which is not quite true, but nearly true. Now, I said it's usually represented as a power law. As you all know, if you only have a relatively limited range of say, temperature to go over, it's very easy to mistake a logarithm for a power law, or vice versa, a small power law. So almost certainly you could fit the specific heat to the formula T log T0 over T, and that, we'll see, may be important later. But what does this indicate? Well, I think it most certainly indicates that there have to be extra low energy degrees of freedom besides the long wavelength phonons in a glass. And ever since 1970, that's more or less been an accepted fact, or accepted a piece of law about glasses. It seems virtually impossible to get this kind of behavior out of long wavelength phonons alone. Second very interesting result, which again is relatively recent, goes back again to probably to about 1970, is the universality of the thermal conductivity of glasses. If you just take the raw data and plot the raw thermal conductivity against temperature on a log scale, here, yeah? It's a log scale, you find that at low temperatures, below about 1 degree absolute, again, it goes as a relatively clean power law temperature, roughly as T to the 2 minus beta, where beta might be somewhere between 0.05 and 0.2. So sort of very crudely comparable to the correction of the specific heat. Then below, between about 1 and 10 degrees or 1 and 30 degrees, you almost always get the so-called plateau in the thermal conductivity. Sometimes it's just about completely flat, sometimes it's slightly sloped, but you always get this. And then again, at a higher temperatures, the thermal conductivity again rises. And you see that these curves, these three curves are plotted for three very different kinds of gloss here. Now, as Anderson, my colleague Andy Anderson and his student Friedman, Justin Freeman at Illinois showed some years ago, if you actually scale this thermal conductivity and scale the temperature in what is, in some sense, a plausible way in terms of the notional Debye temperature of your glass, defined in terms of the speed of sound, etc., then you find that the curve looks even more universal. In fact, both this bit down here and this bit down here, the curves simply collapse onto a single curve. You cannot distinguish between the behavior of different glasses on this reduced plot. And that's now been verified for a fairly large number of different glasses, and as far as I know, there are essentially no exceptions to it. We do have independent evidence that at least for low temperatures, and I think plausibly for all temperatures, though one can't say this for certain, the thermal transport is entirely or mainly by phonons. Whatever else is around is not contributing to the thermal transport. The way you establish this is by drilling little holes, for example, in your material, calculating how they scatter the phonons, and then compare it with the experimental results. So if that's the case, then what you can extract from the reduced plot is a mean free path for the phonons or the ultrasound. And if you consider those phonons which mostly contribute to the thermal conductivity, then it turns out that quite universally, this mean free path is approximately as proportional to the wavelength and approximately 150 times the wavelength in this low temperature region down here. Equivalently, the inverse Q factor, which is something I'm going to be talking about a lot in the rest of this talk, the inverse Q factor, that is the, crudely speaking, the absorption per cycle, is 3 times 10 to the minus 4. And you can actually check that by direct measurements of the ultrasound absorption and velocity. That number is something which has been puzzling me for the last 30 years. Right? And as we'll see, no one really understands it, but it always seems to be 3 plus or minus 2, but maybe times 10 to the minus 4, always in that range. Incidentally, again at high temperatures, you get a very close collapse of the curves onto a single one. Now, interestingly, the mean free path is basically comparable to the wavelength, much shorter up here. Okay? So as I say, this picture, the universal load, value at low temperature, near universal value at high temperature, and a plateau between, which is material dependent, that's almost universal for just about every glass we know. Very, very few exceptions. Very pure amorphous hydrogenated silica, I think, is an exception, but there are very, very few indeed. Okay, perhaps I'll just stop at this, that's the end of my very ultra-brief review of the experimental data that I'm going to be talking about. But let me just stop and ask if there are any questions at this point before I go on. Yeah, sure.
But for various reasons having to do with quantum field theory on random lattices and things, for many years I've been asking people if it's established that there are phonons in glass.
Yeah.
And you've taken it for granted. But usually I don't get a clear answer. Has the experimental situation changed or?
Well, I mean, the experimental situation is that you certainly do get phonons.
You certainly do get phonons. And then related to that, there's a question whether in some sense you've preserved translation invariance or broken it. So you might relate it to a kind of question like, are there umklapp processes in glasses? Is something known about
In some sense, I think you could say that the analog or the nearest analog of umklapp processes is the inelastic, the cubic phonon-phonon interactions. You see, I've written down a Hamiltonian which is purely quadratic, so I haven't got it in cubic terms. If I do put in the cubic terms, yes, they will have an effect, and they will give you a non-zero phonon attenuation, but it'll go as something like over to the fourth, so right. Really scattering.
But they don't, in some sense, break translation invariance, just the cubic term.
Well, I mean, you don't, that's right. I mean, I am always considering my glass to be freely floating, as it were, yes. I think in roughly the same sense as you don't break the translation invariance in a crystal. However, there you have the consequence that you have a special translation by lattice symmetry.
Yeah, there you break it down to a discrete subgroup.
Yes,
but here it the whole.
Well, the Hamiltonian. I mean, it is a case of, if you like, a broken symmetry because the Hamiltonian was translation invariant. But the system is settled into a particular metastable state, which is not translation.
Right. But for the excitation, for the small excitations, the translation symmetry is broken down to a discrete subgroup. And people sometimes associate the Jung-Klopp processes with that quote unquote failure of momentum conservation. Or if you like, exchanging between the momentum of the crystal as a whole and the momentum of the phonons.
Yes, you.
So is it fair to say nothing like that happens here?
I think it's fair to say that. Yeah. Okay, so let me now go on, next part of the talk, to describe briefly what has become the sort of established theory of the thermal and transport properties of glasses at low temperatures. And this is the so-called tunneling two-level system model. It was independently proposed by Anderson, Halperin and Varmer, and Phillips, I guess, way back, or very soon after the original experiments, in fact, way back in the early 70s. So it's a sort of fairly intuitive model. You imagine that because the glass is amorphous, there are always going to be some situations where a particular atom or a group of atoms has available to it not only the particular site into which it's settled, but also another configuration which is close to it, close in energy to it, and also perhaps close in position space. So you imagine that you have, let's just say for definiteness, you have a single atom, although it's much more general than this, a single atom which is can occupy one of two neighboring sites with somewhat different energies by different epsilon. And moreover, it can tunnel. There's quantum mechanical tunneling between the two sites with some amplitude delta. And so if you write down a standard two-state Hamiltonian for this this situation, you've got a diagonal term which is proportional to epsilon or minus epsilon, and you have the tunneling term here. So the energy eigenvalues are given by the square root in the standard way. Now, of course, to get anything out of this, the first thing one needs to know is what is the density of states of your two-level system, and that's given by this expression here. So what you need is the probability of finding an atom having an offset bias here, epsilon, and a particular tunneling amplitude delta. And the answer which is usually made is that these two quantities are independent, which seems vaguely reasonable, no correlation between these two variables. Second postulate, that as a function of the bias, the probability is roughly constant. And again, that seems sort of reasonable because there seems no particular a priori reason why the bias should have any particular value here. So it's reasonable. Now, slightly more tricky consideration pertains to delta. Delta presumably is given by some kind of vaguely WKB-like expression. So if you assume that the WKB exponent is uniformly distributed, which is a big if, then you find that G of delta, this function here, is proportional to delta to the minus one, and therefore the probability of finding a total energy, E, is essentially constant. And generally speaking, that's usually the sort of zeroth order approximation which is made. People do try to correct it somewhat later, but you usually start off with that assumption that the density of states of these alleged two-level systems is roughly constant as a function of the energy splitting. And then there's a standard notation in the literature which just calls that the density of states, the constant density of states, P bar. And you would expect a priori that this is something which would fluctuate quite a bit between different materials, and as we'll see, it does, in fact. If that's the case, well, if you have these two-level systems, they're basically sort of Schottky systems. We all know how to do the theory of the specific heat of independent Schottky systems. So you get a formula for the specific heat, which is proportional to temperature, which is at least approximately in agreement with experiment. Remember, it wasn't actually, experimentally, it's not actually T, but more like T to the 1.2, but never mind, let's live with that for the moment. What about the ultrasound attenuation and velocity? Again, very early work. All this stuff I'm talking about now goes back a good 40 years, most of it. In the canonical energy basis, the two-level systems, they couple to the strain field, which is basically the phonon field, in two different ways. They couple through both the sigma x term and the sigma z term. The sigma x term is what in the language of NMR or quantum information would be called a T1 term, give you a longitudinal relaxation time. The coupling to sigma z would give you part of the T2 term in quantum information language. So these terms give you absorption of ultrasound and spontaneous phonon emission, and there'll be some relaxation time associated with that. And Yerkes, in his thesis, Josef Yerkes, way back in 1972, gave a fairly complete account of what you'd expect in this rather simple model. And what you expect is you get two major regimes which are distinguished by whether the frequency of the phonon you're talking about is large or small compared to the relaxation rate of the two-level system, of a typical two-level system, that is, crudely speaking, the thermally excited ones. In the resonance regime, which is omega tau much greater than one, you'd expect absorption of ultrasound by direct excitation of your two-level systems. That's basically the inverse of a T1 process. Therefore, what you'd expect is that since the density of states of your two-level systems is independent of energy, the inverse Q factor should be independent of omega, and is given by an expression of this type, where gamma here is some kind of mean square coupling to the strain, P bar is the density of states of your two-level systems, rho is the density of the solid, and C squared is the speed of sound squared. And let me just comment that these two quantities you can measure quite directly from macroscopic experiments. These two you have to try to infer in some way from your data on absorption and other things. So at zero temperature, you have this expression for the inverse Q factor. At finite temperature, you have a slightly different problem, because now you can not only absorb a phonon, but you can also have an excited two-level system emitting a phonon. And the probability of excitation will be 1 minus F. You put those two expressions together, and you find that at finite temperatures, this absorption factor is modified by a tangent omega over 2t. Okay. It turns out you can also, if you've got this absorption, then it gives rise to a velocity shift, and you find that the relative to some arbitrary reference temperature, the shift in the speed of sound as a function of temperature is going to be given by this expression. Plug this in, you find this gives you an expression which is proportional to the zero temperature absorption and also proportional to log T over T0. And that does seem, that formula does seem to agree rather well with experiment. In the resonance regime. And it's usually, in fact, it turns out most of our measurements of Q, of the high frequency Q factor, are in fact coming from this measurement. However, all you really had to do to get that is to use the Kramers-Kronig relation, which should be pretty firm. So I don't think there's really an approximation made in getting that. Second regime, relaxation regime, where omega tau is much less than one, crudely speaking, there, the absorption is mostly by the modulation of the TLS, two-level system energy. So it's basically, in quantum information language, it's a T2 kind of process. The theory is more complicated in general, but surprisingly, over much of the, this relaxation regime, a very simple result that the inverse Q factor is independent both of frequency and temperature and simply given by a half of the high frequency Q factor at zero temperature. That's a surprising result. And it actually comes out of some very detailed features of the standard two-level system tunneling model. In the intermediate regime, Q to the minus one is predicted to, and found experimentally, to drop between, below these limiting values. And therefore, we can say, since we already know this result here, we can say that in glasses, for all frequencies and all temperatures, the inverse Q factor, that is the absorption per unit cycle, is always less than or equal to this, this number here. It's quite a surprising statement, in fact. The thermal conductivity can also be calculated, in fact, using, crudely speaking, you use the sort of standard kinetic theory formula. If Q is constant, then goes as the thermal phonon frequency to the minus one, that is T to the minus one, and the phonon. Now, the phonon specific heat, we believe, is proportional to TQ, just as the original naive theory predicted. And therefore, we predict that the thermal conductivity roughly goes as T squared. And you remember that was crudely in agreement with experiment. So far, the two-level system model has given at least approximately a sort of zeroth order agreement with the experiments. Moreover, and this is something which I think really confirmed the validity of this established theory in most people's minds, from very early on, it was realized that if you really had these two-level systems in glasses, then, as we know from a lot of experience with, say, quantum optics or NMR, this is likely to give rise to a whole set of nonlinear effects, like, say, saturation, like echoes, like hole burning, and so on and so forth. And in the 70s, people went away and looked for these, and sure enough, they found exactly these effects. And they found that there were choices you can make of the fitting factors, which would essentially explain these semi-quantitatively. So everything looks fine, first sight. And in fact, for 40 years now, this tunneling two-level system model has been the established theoretical model of what's going on in glasses at low temperatures. What could be wrong with it? Well, the first difficulty, not a knockdown difficulty, but in most glassy systems, you really have no decent microscopic picture of the nature of the two-level systems. Now, there are a few cases where we can make at least reasonable guesses as to what these two-level systems are actually like. For example, if we have potassium bromine doped into potassium cyanide, then it turns out that basically you can have the CN molecule one way around or the other way around, and then it turns out that that does give you plausibly a two-level system model. Second difficulty is this is all very fine as regards the low temperature. Yes.
Is there anything special about two levels? What about three levels?
Well, okay. In some sense, I'll come to that. I think the usual assumption has been that if you have a three-level system, then somehow you can sort of project it onto a two-level system. But it's a good point. One thing I would strongly emphasize is that you can't let this go too far, as it were. And in particular, as we'll see later, you can't have harmonic oscillators. I say there's no explanation of higher temperature phenomena like the so-called boson peak in the specific heat or the plateau in the thermal conductivity. The tunneling two-level system model just doesn't pretend to give any account of those. You need something else for that. At least in the simplest form, in the form it's very widely been used in the literature, people simply neglect the interaction between the two-level systems. As we'll see later, there is a very definite kind of interaction which we know about. This is usually neglected. I think the most, in some sense to my mind, the most damning property of the TTLS model is that, okay, you can explain this, the universality of Q to the of the high frequency Q in the following sense. Within the two-level system, tunneling two-level system model, this is a product of four factors. Okay, this is the coupling to the strain field. This is the density of two-level systems per unit energy, density of material, speed of sound. These two, as I said, you can measure directly. These two, you can't measure directly. You have to use them as fitting factors. So, if you so choose, now in the two-level system model, there are four independent quantities involved here: gamma squared, rho c squared, and p bar. And well, I said you can't measure these, but there are ways of inferring it within the model, in fact, or trying to infer it. And what you find is that these four independent quantities independently fluctuate by something like a factor of 5 to 10 between different materials. Nevertheless, they always seem to conspire to give you this number. Now, if you think that's just a statistical accident, well, I mean, it might be, but I think it's very, very improbable. So I'm going to assume it's not an accident, and that's the basis of the last part of my talk. But let me just stop at this point and ask if there are any questions or comments. Okay, so let me just go on to the last part, which is fairly brief, but this does relate to some work that I've been doing recently so for this part, actually, I do want to switch to my slides, so let me try to find the right button here. That was the RGB, wasn't it, I think?
I just didn't hear one thing. Did you say that that two-level system does explain the universal curve of low and high?
It can explain it if it fits the, if it chooses the numbers always to give this exact coincidence.
But that requires that coincidence to explain the universality of the curve.
Yeah, that's right. Well, to explain the low, for the moment we're just talking about low temperature properties, so not the plateau. But, yeah. Okay, let's see if I can now my slides on. Hopefully it's going to work. So I apologize for the rather crummy writing on these. This is an alternative model of the low temperature property, thermal and acoustic properties of glasses, which I've tried to develop with a former student of mine, Devish Chandvaral, over the last few years. We had one publication on it, which is in the Journal of Non-Crystalline Solids last year. The basic idea is this. We know that there have to be some other degrees of freedom at low energies besides the long wavelength phonons. We're going to put that in, as it were, as an input. However, we're not going to assume anything that we can help about these other degrees of freedom. All that we're going to assume is that their spectrum, whatever it may be, is not harmonic. It could be two level, it could be three level, it could be n level, but the n levels better not be regularly spaced. That's the only thing. We're going to describe this very generically, the system very generically, by a Hamiltonian. First of all, we have the phonon term, which I haven't written explicitly. That's just basically an elastic continuum, Hamiltonian. So we know all about that. And have some kind of zeroth order Hamiltonian of whatever these extra degrees of freedom are. I'll call that H sub zero. And very importantly, we're going to have the way in which this Hamiltonian of the other degrees of freedom varies with the strain. So the important quantity is the linear stress tensor here, which I'll call Tij. So quite generically, then we have the Hamiltonian, the phonons, as it were, unperturbed, other degrees of freedom, and then we have the coupling between these two. Now, the coupling, it's a well-known result, and this was proved by Geoffrin and Lavilliers way back in the 70s, that as a result of the coupling to phonons, at least in a certain frequency regime, this will induce a stress-stress interaction, which is a rather simple structure. It's proportional to... So if I consider two large blocks, let's consider two large blocks of material here with their individual stress tensors. If I couple these together, then I'll find and eliminate So basically what I'm going to do is to take this term, treat it by perturbation theory and eliminate the phonons. And as a result, I'm going to get a 1 over r cubed interaction. This is conceptually very similar to what you do, for example, when you have a magnetic moment coupled to the electromagnetic field. When you eliminate the magnetic field, you produce the 1 over r cubed dipole-dipole interaction. It's pretty similar. The only difference is that this quantity lambda ijkl, which I haven't written out explicitly, is a rather nasty fourth rank tensor. It's a bit more complicated than in the simple magnetic case. The basic object which we're going to try to study is the stress-stress correlation function, which is technically given by this expression. This is a sum over initial states, the susceptibility, as it were, starting from a given initial state, which involves the matrix elements and an energy delta function. And the interesting point, the reason we're going to be particularly interested in this beast, is that the inverse Q factor is simply, apart from a trivial constant, is simply the imaginary part of this chi here. So remember that, the inverse Q factor, the dissipation per cycle, is simply the imaginary part of the stress-stress correlation function. By stress-stress here, I mean that part of the stress which is not itself due to phonons. I mean, the phonon part is trivial, you can take it out, so we're not going to worry about that. Okay, so the general idea we try to develop is that we start off with blocks which are described by some initial Hamiltonian and some initial stress tensor, and to couple them together by this interaction, and as an output, we're going to get a new Hamiltonian for a superblock, the join of these two blocks, and moreover, a new stress tensor here. Now, I wish we could do that analytically from scratch. We can't. I mean, one of the reasons we can't, of course, is that we simply don't know an awful lot about the individual forms of H0 and Tij. These are just very generic for now. However, one thing we might be able to do some useful things nevertheless. Why is this not working? It's not working because, right, of course. Okay, let's put that there. Okay. Now, before I start, before I discuss in a little more detail what we actually did, let me just give you a sort of toy model argument, which goes something like this. And I formulated this, for sort of convenience, in the language of the tunneling two-level system model, which is, in fact, a special case of our model. So you have this expression, which I wrote down earlier, for the inverse Q factor. The question is, what is the density of states which comes into that? Suppose we assume, as is not usually assumed, this is in some sense a minority point of view, let's assume that the interaction terms actually dominate here, the interactions between the two-level systems. Then, as before, the induced interaction is proportional to G over R cubed. G has various factors in it. It has this gamma squared, which in the more general language is simply the stress tensor, matrix element squared, a typical stress tensor matrix element. It also, however, is proportional, and this is very important, it's proportional to the number of phonons which are inducing the 1 over r cubed interaction. Okay? It's also proportional to these things. Now, on rather generally, if you know that you've got a constant density of states, and within the model you do from your specific heat, then you can say that the p bar has to be proportional to the inverse of g. Again, that's in when the interaction dominates, in the limit where the interaction dominates. This, incidentally, is a result which is, I guess, known in the theory of spin glasses for some time. So p bar, now, putting these together, p bar goes as rho c squared over n gamma squared, plug that back into here, what you find is everything else drops out of the argument. And you find that the inverse Q factor is simply proportional to the inverse of the number of colors, as it were, of your phonons, and is universal. So this is a very, very neat result. I mean, the physics is rather simple. You're trying to look at the absorption of a phonon, but your energy spectrum comes out, at least in this limit, as a product of the interaction, which is itself induced by phonons. So there has to be some kind of simple relation between these two. So indeed, you get this rather nice result that the inverse Q factor is universal. However, there's a rather large problem. because n, in our case, is only 3. And therefore, you'd expect the inverse Q factor would be, well, at best a third, right? Actually, it's 3 × 10⁻⁴. So you're way, way off by several orders of magnitude here. So the only way of, as it were, accommodating this in this model is that if you had something like 3,000 different colors of phonons, which obviously you don't in real life. So something's gone wrong. So I'm going to very briefly sketch. I don't really expect you to, well, I haven't even written out all the details here because I think they are too technical. And you know, if you're interested, you can look at our paper. But basically, we now try to implement this real space renormalization procedure, which I mentioned. That is, we try to start with a particular value of q to the minus 1, which I'll put a subscript L for the size of the block here. Try to combine blocks together to produce a super block here. Work out how q has changed as I go from here to here. And skipping, I'll skip the details. The salient point is that when you actually work out, or try to work out using various assumptions, the way in which you scale from small blocks to large blocks, the only thing which comes in the result is two numerical factors. This one is totally universal, it's just a geometrical factor. This one here does involve certain properties of the material. However, those properties are simply the ratios of the transverse and ultrasound and longitudinal ultrasound absorption. It's something we can measure quite directly. That's almost always close to 2.6, you know, almost all materials. Again, we have the 1 minus CT squared of CL squared. Well, you remember that we had a theoretical value for this. The experiments almost always do agree with this. It's almost always about 0.6. There are very small fluctuations around these two numbers between different materials. These are the only things that come in in the answer, as it were. Okay, so as I'll leave out the details of this, they're not interesting. The interesting thing, I think, is the output. The output is that for a single step of the renormalization procedure, you find that Q is always reduced by this coupling. And the factor, which is reduced, always involves this number, K0, which again is practically universal. It's not 100% universal between materials, but it fluctuates by only something like less than 10% between different materials. So it really is quasi-universal here. Now you can go on iterating. You can combine, having combined, say, 8 small blocks into 1 large one, you can then combine 8 large blocks further and further, etc. And if we eventually iterate to experimental length scales, we find this result here. You find that Q factor has been reduced. And moreover, what's very interesting is that it's predicted that if R goes to infinity, that is, we consider infinite wavelength of sound at zero temperature, I have to say, then in fact there will be no absorption whatever. That's a very peculiar result, and I'm not totally sure that I believe it, though I don't know of any simple thermodynamic argument which says it can't happen. But if we now take the experimental length scale, of course, this number here, I haven't told you, incidentally, what my starting value of L was, and for reasons I'll mention if anyone asks me, I've taken that to be about 50 angstroms. There is a reason for doing that, but it's rather complicated to explain at this stage. We find that our inverse Q factor has been knocked down from the original sort of intuitive value of 1/3 or whatever down to about 0.015, which is good, but not good enough. Okay. Well, however, that's the average Q factor over a large frequency range. We know that can't be right. Why can't it? Because if you plug in a constant Q factor into your Kramers-Kronig formula, you found that at zero temperature, the compressibility is infinite, so your whole system just collapses. And we assume that's not going to happen. So that means that Q must actually be slowly decreasing as we decrease omega. It can actually, the slowest decrease you can allow is log omega to the minus 1 plus epsilon, where epsilon is some small number. Yeah. And the question is, does it do that? Then we have I think I'll skip the next part of the argument. Not that easy to understand, and secondly, in any case, it's based on a conjecture. So, but the conjecture, as a result of the output of the conjecture, is that indeed it goes roughly as 1 over log omega. And there's an interesting argument here based on whether you believe second order perturbation theory or not, which if anyone wants to ask me, I can tell them questions. But let me just get to the punchline. We conjecture this form of Q, which does seem to be in reasonably good agreement with experimental data, for example, on thermal conductivity and so forth. And if you now fit A from consistency with our result for the average Q factor, and this was Dervish's great idea, I think, to do this, this indeed turns out to give for when omega is about the experimental value, about 1 megahertz, say, it gives you a Q to the minus 1 of 2.7 times 10 to the minus 4, which is just about bang on the experimental value. As I say, this does fit the ultrasonic data reasonably well. It predicts a thermal conductivity, which goes as this formula here, which is easily mistaken for 2 minus beta. So it's a conjecture, but at least it does seem consistent with what we know about glasses. Okay, finally, I have to stop a moment. So finally, as I say, if you're interested in the messy details of this, they are all in our paper in the Journal of Non-Crystalline Solids. So, sorry, this is what I've done here. If the above argument, if the argument I've given is correct, and as I say, it is based, for now, it's based on conjecture, so it may not be correct. If it is correct, then the observed value of the inverse Q factor, 3 times 10 to the minus 4, is the maximum attainable in any glassy material. It's not, it doesn't have to be that large. If I start off with no absorption whatever, then I'll end up with no absorption whatever. But I can't get a value greater than this for the absorption. So that means, in turn, that since there's actually nothing in this argument which says I've got to be glassy, I could be crystalline, in fact. It's just a special case of this. So this leads to a very interesting conclusion. It leads to an absolute lower limit on the thermal conductivity of any material, solid, liquid, crystalline, glassy, whatever. I think is really rather amusing. It's true. Some further questions. The first, most obvious question is, I've told you, without going into the details, that our quantitative results are based, at least partly, on a conjecture. Can we get around that conjecture? Can we do better than this? I believe we can, and very recently, I've come to realize that possibly a variant of the approach used by Eftrosch and Shklovsky for disordered semiconductors may actually give us what we need here. It may actually produce for us a rigorous upper limit on the absorption. So far, we haven't explored that in detail. Second problem we haven't dealt with at all so far is the ultrasound absorption in the relaxational regime. So far, the considerations that Dervish and I have given are entirely to do with the resonant regime. Thirdly, obvious question, can we explain the nonlinear phenomena? I believe we can. I believe that the condition, it's not that two-level systems are special, it's that harmonic oscillators are special. So long as you don't have a set of harmonic oscillators, then I believe you're always going to get some kind of nonlinear phenomena occurring. Can we explain the plateau in Kappa and the boson peak in the specific heat? Well, we have some ideas along those lines. Can we explain the higher temperature behavior of Kappa, which is quasi-universal with a Q factor of the order of 1, remember? So it's much more absorption, but it still seems to be more or less universal. And I actually believe there is a tentative way of looking at that. It's rather technical. It involves the fact that the expression we used involving this 1 over r cubed interaction is actually only valid over a certain regime. Crudely speaking, the matrix element for the coupling has to be small compared to the energy of the phonon which is exchanged to give you the coupling. There are similar things which are known to happen in quantum optics and so forth. So you get what I call an Ising-Heisenberg crossover. At high temperatures, the system is well described by an Ising model. Then at low temperatures, all the components, as it were, of your interaction come in, and you've got a Heisenberg model. And I believe that may give you this this factor of something like 150 as you cross over from one to the other. But that's, for the moment at least, that's not not established. So finally, I just want to leave you with one thought. I believe that, where's it gone to? As I say, the whole philosophy which has governed the writing of innumerable textbooks on solid-state physics for the last 80 years or so has been that, in some sense, crystals are the perfect form of solid, and that glasses are a rather unfortunate and regrettable kind of a deviation from that. And I believe we really, in the 21st century, we really ought to adopt the slogan that glasses are the norm, and it's the crystals which are the anomaly. So, thank you.
Glass density should be on the whole less than the solid density.
That's a good question. I think that's probably right. I mean, certainly, I think intuitively you think that that's right, because in some sense the solid ought to correspond to the closest possible packing, and you don't have that in general glass. I'm not sure what the experimental situation is on that. I suspect it is that way around, but I couldn't swear to it.
Have different glasses, the density of different materials would be...
Well, I mean, you know, you have to remember that you're talking about glasses which are made out of all sorts of different actually atomic components. So you might have, for example, boron oxide on the one hand or lead oxide on the other. And, you know, since the atoms are so different, that means the density could be different by a factor of 10 easily.
At some point you gave an argument that the Q must go to infinity, or the absorption must go to zero at very long wavelengths.
That's right.
At zero temperature.
Yeah.
Did that depend on the model, or it sounded like almost it was independent?
Yeah, I think it is. Provided the rather sort of generic assumptions of our argument are right, yes, I think it is a generic result. Yes.
A related question is, in your model just assumed more or less any finite state system. Not a harmonic oscillator.
Exactly.
But the two-level one is a special case of your model.
Yeah, it is, yes.
So did it also give this universal curve with the wrong value of n, with the wrong number?
That's an interesting question. No one, to the best of my knowledge, no one has taken seriously an effective Hamiltonian where you've eliminated the fermions to second order and kept all the tensor components. Now, there are papers in the literature. These are, in some sense, using the same kind of philosophy as we're using. There are a group of papers by Burin and Kagan, which go some way in this direction. But they only keep, as it were, the Ising component of the, that is, they only keep the ZZ component of the stress tensor interaction. And they do derive some results which are somewhat similar to ours. Again, they get a one over log type of behavior. So I think to that extent one can say yes, the two-level systems do give you these results, but we haven't actually implemented this scheme specifically for two-level systems, and in fact I think it would be as difficult to do it for two-level systems as it is for the generic case.
Is there anything you think we can learn or not learn by doing experiments or calculation on three-dimensional Edward Anderson Heisenberg spin glasses?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the whole question of whether, how much structural glasses, which is what I've been talking about, and spin glasses have in common is one which has been somewhat discussed. My own feeling is that for many purposes, for example, if you're considering things like the specific heat, there may well be a lot in common. And in fact, this argument I gave you, which came out with this universal value of order one, that was first, to my knowledge, actually something rather like this was proposed by Fish in the theory of spin glasses way back in the 70s, in fact. So to that extent, they do have something in common. But I think what's, at first sight at least, rather special here is that the experimental quantity in which you're most interested in, which is the ultrasound absorption, is directly related to the thing which mediates the interactions, as it were. Now, it has occurred to me, and I haven't got around to doing anything about this yet, that in principle, at least, there ought to be a rather similar situation which occurs in the electromagnetic properties of solids. Again, you see, if I'm considering electromagnetic absorption, what's being absorbed, it is photons. What's transmitting the Coulomb and Ampere interaction is photons. So again, you'd think there might be something to be got out of that, but I haven't investigated that seriously at this point.
Have you extended this to look at temperature dependence of various quantities?
Well, I mean, what we've got so far is that if our ansatz for the frequency dependence of the ultrasound is correct, then it should give you a thermal conductivity, which is T squared log T zero over T. And as I say, that's very easy to, since you've only got a couple of decades, as it were, to work on, that's very easy to mistake for the experimental, for the power law, which is usually quoted as a result. So to that extent, yes. Yeah.
Also, do you have a, I mean, when you talked about two levels, you said people don't really know what the levels are.
That's right.
Do you have any, this doesn't tell you any more of what the levels might be?
No, if anything tells you less.
Tells you less. Well, now you have to get
yes, I mean, it simply says, well, you've got some kind of source of entropy there, which is other than the phonons, we just don't know what it is. And we don't need to know what it is, luckily, with this program.
One question.
And this might be a little crazy, but people have, in context of ADS, CFT, and so on, they've talked about universal lower bounds on viscosity, viscosity for entropy, something like that. Is there anything, any connection?
I suspect there probably is, but I haven't been able to dig it out yet. I think one very interesting thing, at least to the best of my knowledge, although there is this entropy viscosity relationship which people have derived within the ADS-CFT approach, as far as I know, correct me if I'm wrong, but this does seem to be satisfied by all known condensed matter systems. And yet, no one, as far as I know, knows how to derive it within a purely condensed matter framework. Is it right? There surely has to be. There has to be some sort of rather basic reason why it's right. We don't know.
I think in very exotic field theories, people have found apparent counterexamples, but it still looks like a very generally true.
Well, I mean, I can think of one rather trivial counterexample, when people don't usually take it seriously when I propose it, but it's fairly obvious that, I mean, if you think about a charged system, which way, let's see, just remind me which way around the inequality goes, is the expression involving the viscosity as an upper or lower bound on the entropy. I can never remember which way it is.
I think it's viscosity over entropy.
Viscosity over entropy has to be larger than, Yeah. If you do this for type 2 superconductors with pin vortices, you find it doesn't work. But I think it's a sort of trivial counterexample.
Is there anything known about the entropy at TG among glasses?
Nothing.
Residual entropy.
Sorry?
Residual entropy.
Yeah. In fact, there are some interesting paradoxes related to that. I'm just trying to get this right. The Kaltzmann's paradox, I guess, says that if you extrapolate, I think this is right, which way around it is, if you extrapolate the specific heat of the supercooled liquid, you get a down to zero temperature, you get a sort of totally unphysical result, I guess. Yeah, experimentally, yes, there's quite a lot known about there's no latent heat. As far as we know, at glass transition, which would square with it not being a genuine phase transition, I guess. But it does; the entropy does change quite considerably between the supercooled liquid and glass phases.
More questions? Thank you.